This is Setting the Record Straight. I'm Charles Coughlin.
This is BreadboxMedia.com.
We're going to be examining the effect of the Catholic Church on the arts, on music, on architecture, painting, mosaics, drama. The artistic inheritance of the West, of Christendom, is so strongly identified with Catholic images that no one would wish to deny the Church's influence. The Catholic role has been significantly greater, however, than simply providing the subject matter for Western art. The very fact that we possess many of our artistic masterpieces at all is itself a reflection of Catholic ideas. The 8th and 9th century witnessed the growth of a destructive heresy called iconoclasm. Iconoclasm, breaking of icons. In other words, the destruction of images. Iconoclasm rejected the veneration of images, of icons, of religious figures. Indeed, iconoclasm went so far as to reject the depiction of Christ and the saints in art at all. Had that idea taken hold of beautiful paintings, sculptures, mosaics, stained glass, illuminated manuscripts, and cathedral facades that have delighted and inspired spiritually Westerners and non-Westerners alike, would never have come into being. Not in Christendom, not in the Catholic world, since it ran directly counter to the Catholic understanding of and appreciation of the created world. The concept of images, whether the images are done with oils, mosaic tiles, in music, in literature, is intimately bound up with a deep understanding of the incarnation, of the validation of matter and flesh, of the earth itself, through God becoming matter himself. It's ironic that iconoclasm has been revived among some sects of modern Protestants who value the Bible so much, itself an image made of words graven upon a page. For image is never the thing itself, but a representational symbol of the thing itself, graven upon a page. The irony deepens when one examines the Old Testament's description of the creation of the Ark of the Covenant, which has images upon it. Two golden cherubs of hammered workmanship, one at each end of the cover facing each other, with heads bowed and wings extending upward and overspreading the ark. This careful design was not originated by man, but by God, who directed Moses to construct it according to God's careful design, and to create images on it. The first thing that Jehovah gave Moses when instructing him to build the tabernacle was the pattern and design of the ark. For indeed it was the central and paramount object of the tabernacle and the whole camp of Israel. Certainly Moses was one in a long line of artists who have been inspired by God to create images. Indeed, artists who were able to describe most honestly the results of their careful self-examination when it is done with deep skepticism and ruthless clarity, know that their creations are inspired. Many artists, musicians, writers, describe another voice that seems to originate from somewhere else, from outside themselves. They're often heard to say that the designs came to them, the words came to them, the music came to them, from someone else, as if there was a celestial voice, as if their creation was inspired, breathed into them. It came from somewhere else. Fra Angelico knelt when he painted the heavens. Michelangelo painted the heavens on the Sistine Chapel. Where did these images come from? Where did the image, the specifications for the design of the Ark of the Covenant come from? From God's voice to Moses. We know this because it's in the images in the Bible, in the word images, which are God's words told in the symbols of man, in the images of God's voice that man has invented. In Exodus 25, verse 18, God said, "And make two cherubim out of hammered gold at the ends of the cover. Make one cherub on one end and the second cherub on the other. Make the cherubim of one piece with the cover at the two ends. The cherubim are to have their wings spread upward, overshadowing the cover with them. The cherubim are to face each other, looking toward the cover. Place the cover on top of the ark and put the ark and put in the ark the tablets of the covenant law that I will give you. There above the cover, between the two cherubim that are over the ark of the covenant law, I will meet with you and give you all my commands for the Israelites. Now cherubim are not the little baby images that we often associate with that word. They're the guardians of God. They're the guardians of God's word. They represent safety. God gave careful specifications to Moses on how to construct this design. To build a chest, 2.5 cubits long, 1.5 cubits wide, and 1.5 cubits high. It was made of acacia wood, overlaid inside and out with pure gold, as God himself directed. Does it occur to you that our church often receives criticism when we sacrifice our gold to be melted into sacred images and to be placed in a sacred place in honor of God, most especially to inspire the spirits and faith of our fellow aspirant saints? What about the use of all this gold? Many have criticized it. But in God's specifications, there's even more use of gold. An artistic border of gold served as a crowning wreath round about it. The second section of the ark, its cover, was made of solid gold, not just wood overlaid with gold, and was the full length and breadth of the chest. Mounted on this cover, as I want to reemphasize, were the images, sculptures, of two golden cherubs of hammered workmanship, one at each end of the cover facing each other, with heads bowed and wings extending upward and overspreading the ark. The cover itself was also known as the mercy seat, or propitiatory cover. As I have said now, the iconoclasts, in their breaking of images and destruction of images that has occurred throughout the centuries, including Henry VIII's demolition of beautiful monasteries and eliminations of a long tradition of great English sculpture of sacred images, all of this iconoclasm runs directly counter to the Catholic understanding of the incarnation, of the raising up of the material to become imbued with the Spirit, become one with it. Where did this iconoclastic spirit originate? Well, after the time of Christ, it originated in the Byzantine Empire rather than in Western Europe. Though it claimed to teach a doctrine that all believers in Christ must accept on pain of heresy, it was introduced by the Byzantine Emperor Leo III in the 700s. For reasons that remain obscure, the Byzantine encounter with Islam likely played a role. From the first century of the existence of Islam, when Muslims had overrun the eastern portions of the Byzantine Empire, the emperor in Constantinople had had to organize and struggle against this persistent and powerful foe. In the course of that struggle, he could not help but notice that Islamic art was not representational at all. No depictions of Muhammad, the founder of Islam, were to be found. Eventually, Leo III began to consider abolishing the use of icons among Eastern Christians, on the grounds that perhaps the reason for continuing Muslim victories and Byzantine defeats on the battlefield was that God was punishing the Byzantines for their use of icons. Now, as far as Western Europe was concerned, iconoclasm was a flagrant heresy. Christian art had depicted Christ and the saints for centuries by the time of the iconoclasm controversy. The depiction of Christ in art was a reflection of Catholic doctrine of the Incarnation. With the incarnation of God in Jesus Christ, the material world, while nevertheless fallen, has been elevated to a new level. It was not to be despised. It was not dirty. It was not filthy. For not only had God created it, but he had also dwelt in it. St. John of Damascus condemned iconoclasm on these very grounds. He spent much of his life as a monk near Jerusalem between the 720s and 740s. He wrote his three treatises on the divine images in response to iconoclasm. Naturally, much of his argument was based on biblical and patristic citations, as well as the testimony of tradition as a whole with regard to the specific question of whether God really opposed the veneration of images as the iconoclast claimed. But he also offered important theological defenses of religious art. John detected within the iconoclast position a tendency toward Manichaeism, a heresy that had divided the world into a realm of wickedness, that of matter, and one of goodness, that of the spirit. The idea that material things could communicate spiritual good was utter nonsense to the Manichae. In the 12th and 13th century, Catharism, a variant of Manichaeism, pursued the same line of thought to suggest that the Catholic sacramental system must be fraudulent. For how could wicked matter, in the form of water, consecrated oils, bread, and wine, communicate purely spiritual grace to the recipient? I quote John of Damascus. "You abuse matter and call it worthless," he said. He scolded the iconoclasts. So do the Manichaeists. But the divine scripture proclaims that it is good. For it says, quote, "And God saw everything that he had made, and behold, it was exceedingly good." John was careful to point out that he did not, quote, "reverence matter as God." Far from it. How can that which has come to be from nothing be God? But matter, which the Christian could not condemn as wicked in itself, could convey something of the divine. Allow me to credit Thomas Woods, the wonderful writer, for these concepts and words. After the break, I want to read you some wonderful words on this explaining the Catholic position, written by St. John of Damascus. And then I will address the matter of the mistranslation of the words of the First Commandment, which was intended to prohibit idolatry, not image-making.
This is BreadboxMedia.com.
We'll be back after the break.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit BreadboxMedia.com.
Welcome back to Setting the Record Straight. I've been talking about art at the Catholic Church, and on the subtopic of images and iconoclasm. And I'd referred to St. John of Damascus, defending the Catholic Church from the attack of the iconoclasts. Just before the break, I'd promised to read some of these wonderful words written by St. John of Damascus. So here it is. "I do not venerate matter, I venerate the fashioner of matter, who became matter through the Incarnation, for my sake, and accepted to dwell in matter, and through matter worked my salvation. I will not cease from reverencing matter, through which my salvation was worked. Therefore I reverence the rest of matter, and hold in respect that through which my salvation came, because it is filled with divine energy and grace. Is not the thrice precious and thrice blessed wood of the cross matter? Is not the holy and august mountain, the place of the skull, matter? Is not the life-giving and life-bearing rock, the holy tomb, the source of the resurrection, matter? Is not the ink in the all-holy book of the Gospels, matter? Is not the life-bearing table which offers to us the bread of life, matter? Is not the gold and silver, matter, out of which crosses and tablets and bowls are fashioned? And before all these things, is not the body and blood of my Lord, matter? Either do away with reverence and veneration for all these, or submit to the tradition of the Church and allow the veneration of images of God and of friends of God, sanctified by name and therefore overshadowed by the grace of the Divine Spirit." I must say, John wrote most eloquently. Thus, theologians referred to Catholic theological principles in defense of art that depicted Christ, the saints, and religious scenes that have defined so much of Western artistic life. In the year 843, the Byzantines themselves finally abandoned iconoclasm and returned to depicting Christ and the saints in art. An annual celebration of the, quote, "triumph of Orthodoxy" commemorated the return of the traditional practice in the veneration of icons. It is difficult to overstate the significance of the Catholic Church's official opposition to iconoclasm. The Third Council of Nicaea in 787 condemned it. The ideas of St. John of Damascus and his supporters later permitted us the luxury of the beautiful Madonnas of Raphael, the Pietà of Michelangelo, and countless other works of passion and genius, not to mention the great cathedral facades, which often depicted Christ, the apostles, and the saints. This favorable view of representational religious art cannot simply be taken for granted as something natural and inevitable. Islam, after all, has never abandoned its insistence on an anacanonic, non-image art. Rehabilitating the iconoclast heresy in the 16th century, Henry VIII and other Protestants went on a rampage of smashing statues, altarpieces, stained glass windows, and other great treasures of Western art. John Calvin, arguably the most significant Protestant thinker of all, favored visually barren settings for his worship service and even prohibited the use of musical instruments. Nothing could have been further removed from the joyous Catholic Church respect for the natural world. Inspired by the Incarnation and its belief that human images, composed of body, matter, and soul, can be aided in their ascent to God with the aid of material things. Now let's take up the matter of the mischievous mistranslation of the First Commandment and the word image in the First Commandment. I'm sure we've all encountered errors that, even when thoroughly proven to be errors, that the perpetrators of them persist indelibly, like indelible ink, to bring them up again and again, as if they had never been proven false. The last entry on that table in the last line quotes from Exodus chapter 20, verse 4. The Vulgate Latin version, non facias tibi sculptili. In other words, to be translated accurately, thou shalt not make to thyself any graven thing. Fourth line. The mischievous mistranslation, thou shalt not make to thyself any graven image, rather than thing. They've substituted the word image. And it remained uncorrected in the final versions in 1682. Thou shalt not make to thyself, thou shalt not make to thee any graven image. Now there are other entries on the table showing other examples in the Bible where this same error was consistently committed. Now Thomas Wood on page 65 writes this. A warning here. This book was written in 1807. So the language in those days was somewhat more fiery than we're accustomed to in our mild, excessively mild, perhaps, age. At least there's clarity in what he means. Paragraph 31. Beside their falsely translating, quote, image instead of, quote, idol, they have also another way of falsifying and corrupting the scripture by introducing the word image into the text, when in the Hebrew or Greek there is no such thing, as in these notorious examples, to the image of Baal, the image that came down from Jupiter, where they are not content to understand image rather than idol, but they must intrude it into the text, though they know full well it is not in the Greek. Not unlike this kind of falsification is that which is corrupt as a leprosy through all their Bibles, and which it seems they are resolved never to correct, their translating of sculptivi and conflatili, graven image and molten image, namely in the First Commandment, where they cannot be ignorant that in the Greek it is idol, and in the Hebrew such a word as signifies only a graven thing, not including this word image. They know that God commanded to make images of cherubim and of oxen in the temple, and of the brazen serpent in the desert. And therefore their wisdoms might have considered that he forbade not all graven images, but such as the Gentiles made in worship for gods. Non factis tibi sculptile coincide with those words that go before. Thou shalt have no other gods before me. For to so have an image as to make it a god is to make it more than an image. And therefore, when it is an idol, as were the idols of the Gentiles, then it is forbidden by this commandment. Otherwise, the cross stood for many years upon the table in Queen Elizabeth's chapel. Pray, was it against this commandment? Or was it idolatry in her majesty, her counselors, that it was appointed there? In our present zeitgeist in 21st century America, we may see this language as being too forward, too bold, too impolite. This is the way people wrote in those times, in the early 1800s. It was very clear. It was very candid. Let us return now to the subject of Catholic art and Catholic images, Catholic music. Arguably, the greatest contributions Catholics made to art, and the one that has undoubtedly and permanently influenced the European landscape, is the medieval cathedral. One art historian recently wrote, The medieval cathedrals of Europe are the greatest accomplishments of humanity in the whole theater of art. I know William James referred to them as sermons in stone, conveying the great power of wordless gospel. Particularly stunning are Europe's Gothic cathedrals. Gothic architecture developed out of the Romanesque style in the 12th century and spread throughout Europe to varying degrees from its origin in France and England. These buildings, monumental in size and scope, are characterized by certain distinguishing features, including the beautiful flying buttress, the pointed arch, and the ribbed vault. Their combined effect, including the much-admired stained glass of the Gothic tradition, is an extraordinary testament to the supernatural faith of a civilization. And I want to mention that the stained glass windows, which were consistently of stories from the Bible, were considered the Bible of the illiterate, which was most people at one time. The Roman Empire had 10% literacy. That was 7.5 million people, enough to maintain a civilization. But that left many people unable to read the Bible. An interesting thing about the cathedrals is that they reveal an impressive geometric coherence. That coherence follows directly from an important strain in Catholic thought. St. Augustine made repeated references to Wisdom 11:21, an Old Testament verse that describes God as having, quote, ordered all things by measure, number, and weight. This idea became common currency among great many Catholic thinkers, particularly those associated with the great cathedral school at Chartres in the 12th century. It played a central role in the construction of Gothic cathedrals. As an aside, I want to mention that the fully formulated scientific method was developed at the cathedral school at Chartres in the 12th century. Interesting confluence of science and art. But back to the arts. At the time that Gothic architecture was evolving from its Romanesque predecessor, more and more Catholic thinkers were becoming persuaded of the link between mathematics, geometry in particular, and God. Ever since Pythagoras and Plato, an important strain of thought within Western civilization had identified mathematics with the divine. At Chartres, explains Robert Scott, scholars believed that geometry was a means for linking human beings to God, that mathematics was a vehicle for revealing to humankind the innermost secrets of heaven. They thought the harmony of musical consonants was based on the same ratio as those forming cosmic order, that the cosmos was a work of architecture, and God was its architect. These ideas led builders to conceive of architecture as applied geometry, geometry as applied theology, and the designer of a Gothic cathedral as an imitator of the divine master. Just as the great geometer created the world in order and harmony, explains Professor John Baldwin, so the Gothic architect, in his small way, attempted to fashion God's earthly abode in accordance to the supreme principles of proportion and beauty. This was called the Scholastic Age. The scholastic frame of mind has sometimes been credited with giving rise to the Gothic cathedral. The scholastics, of whom St. Thomas Aquinas was the most illustrious example, were intellectual system builders. They sought not merely to answer this or that question, but to construct entire edifices of thought. Their summae, in which they sought to explore every significant question pertaining to their subject, systematic, coherent wholes, in which each individual conclusion related harmoniously to every other, just as the various components of the Gothic cathedral worked together to create a structure of remarkable internal coherence.
This is BreadboxMedia.com.
Breadbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit BreadboxMedia.com.
This is BreadboxMedia.com.
Welcome back. We were discussing the art of the Catholic Church, the justification for having any representational art at all, or any art at all, which had been challenged at various times through history. And also the remarkable and towering achievement of Catholic art, quite unmatched anywhere. Let us fly back in time to the early centuries. just after Christ. The catacombs. There was art in the catacombs. The very first Christians of the apostolic age created art. Some of this can be seen in the catacombs. Between the end of the 4th and the beginning of the 5th centuries, the fathers of the church described the catacombs. St. Jerome was the first to recount how, as a student, he would go on Sundays to visit the tombs of the apostles and the martyrs together with his study companions. He said, "We would enter the galleries dug into the bowels of the earth. Rare lights coming from above land attenuated the darkness a little, and we would proceed slowly, one step at a time, completely enveloped in darkness." The Iberian poet Prudentius also recalls that in the early years of the 5th century, many pilgrims would come from around Rome and even from surrounding regions to venerate the tomb of the martyr Hippolytus, who was buried in the catacombs. In the second half of the 4th century, Pope Damasus began the search for the tombs of the martyrs located in the different catacombs of Rome. After the tombs were found, he had them restored and had splendid praises engraved in honor of these first champions of the faith. In the 6th centuries, Pope Vigilius and John III also restored the catacombs after the incursions due to the Greek-Gothic War. Subsequently, between the 8th and 9th century, Popes Hadrian I and Leo II also restored the martyrs' shrines in the Roman catacombs. After a long period of oblivion, the rediscovery of these catacombs in the 16th centuries offered valuable testimonies of the first Christians' genuine faith. That were used in the Counter-Reformation movement. The point of this is that there were images all over the catacomb walls, inscriptions, medals, glass objects, rather expertly done depictions in some cases, of people and individuals engaging in their early Catholicism. In our time, we've become accustomed to calling these people the early Christians, but they were more particularly, one and all, the early Catholics, because it was called the Catholic Church by the end of the first century. And the art there establishes that the practices of today's Catholic Church are very much the same as those of the 1st century, 2nd century, 3rd century, much as an examination of the Church Fathers' writings will confirm this. As Cardinal Newman said, "To go deep into history is to cease to be Protestant." And this art, quite apart from its decorative beauty, goes a long way to establishing the case that this is the same Catholic Church that it was at that time. But let's talk about the art itself. From the end of the 2nd century, an extremely simple art developed in the catacombs, which is in part narrative and in part symbolic. The paintings, mosaics, reliefs on the sarcophaguses, and minor arts recall stories from the Old and New Testaments, as if to present examples of salvation from the past to the new converts. If you would like to see some of the better examples and well-done representations of figures in the catacombs done by the early Catholics, visit the Vatican website, www.vatican.va, and search within that website for the catacombs. Let's move now geographically to Byzantium, to the Eastern Roman Empire, centered around the capital, Constantinople. We can examine Byzantine art for a period that encompasses the 300s, the 400s, and the 500s. It is said that the great achievements of this Byzantine civilization were governmental administration and the decorative arts. A state that survived 11 centuries and a St. Sophia that stands today. By the Emperor Justinian's time, pagan art was half its works had been mutilated or destroyed. Several Christian emperors, notably Honorius and Theodosius II, did their best to protect the old structures. An enlightened clergyman preserved the Parthenon, the Temple of Theseus, and the Pantheon, and other structures by rededicating them as Christian shrines. When Catholicism had triumphed, and great basilicas were needed to house the swelling congregations, the local and national traditions of art reasserted themselves, and architecture lifted itself out of the ruins. These spacious edifices cried out for decoration. The worshippers needed statues of Christ and of Mary to help the imagination and pictures to tell to the simple people who were illiterate the story of the crucified God. Sculpture, mosaic, and painting were reborn. Byzantine art dedicated itself to explaining the doctrines of Christianity and of displaying the glory of the state. It recounted on vestments and tapestries, in mosaics and murals, the life of Christ, the sorrows of Mary, the lives of the apostles or martyrs whose bones were enshrined in the church. Or it entered the court, decorated the palace of the sovereign, covered his official robes with symbolic emblems or historical designs, dazzled his subjects with flamboyant pageantry, covered his official robes with symbolic emblems or historical designs, dazzled his subject with flamboyant pageantry. The Byzantine artist had small choice of patron, and therefore of subject or style. Monarch or patriarch told him what to do and how. He worked in a group and seldom left an individual name to history. But he achieved miracles of brilliance. He exalted and humbled the people with the splendor of his creations. The Byzantines' greatest achievement in the arts was in architecture. And perhaps the greatest of these is the Hagia Sophia, which can be seen today, although the Muslims have taken it over and stripped it of almost all its magnificent mosaics and certainly all its statuary. The Emperor Justinian himself shared busily in the design and construction and took no small part in solving technical problems. The ground plan was a Greek cross, 250 by 225 feet, each end of the cross covered by a minor dome. The dome was magnificent, not only in size, but in its amazing support. It rested not on a circular structure, as in the Pantheon, but on pendentives and arches that mediated between the circular run and the square base. Never has this architectural problem been more satisfactorily solved. It has been described as a work admirable and terrifying, seeming not to rest on the masonry below, but to be suspended by a chain of gold from the height of the sky. The interior was a panorama of luminous decoration, marble of many colors, white, green, yellow, purple, gold, made the pavement walls and two-story colonnades look like a field of flowers. Mosaics of unprecedented scope and splendor look down from the walls and vaults. Of course, these can't be seen now, the Muslim iconoclasts having removed them or plastered them over. 40 silver chandeliers hanging down from the rim of the dome helped as many windows to illuminate the church. Hagia Sophia, or St. Sophia as it is called, Holy Wisdom, was at once the inauguration and culmination of the Byzantium style. It was called the Great Church, yet one man, Procopius, wrote of it, "When one enters this building to pray, he feels that it is not the work of human power. The soul, lifting itself to the sky, realizes that here God is close by, and that he takes delight in this, his chosen home." Whereas architecture was the masterpiece of the Byzantine artist, but about it or within it were a dozen other arts in which he achieved some memorable excellence. There's not a lot of sculpture in the round, the mood of the age preferred color to line. Yet scholars have lauded the sculptors of those times, presumably the carvers of reliefs, as the equals of Phidias and Praxiteles. Some of the sarcophagi of the 4th, 5th, and 6th centuries have human figures chiseled with an almost Greek grace, confused with an Asiatic plethora of ornament. The carving of ivory was a favorite art among the Byzantines. They used it for everything: book covers, caskets, perfume boxes, statuette, inlays, in hundreds of decorative ways. As far as painting is concerned, Byzantine painting stuck to traditional Greek methods. Encaustic colors burnt into panels of wood, colors mixed with lime and applied to wet plaster on surfaces, and tempera, colors mixed with size or gum or glue and white of egg, and applied to panels or to plaster, alternately, already dry. Loving brilliance and permanence, the Byzantine painter made mosaic his favorite medium. For floors, he chose tesserae, those are tiles, of colored marble, as Egyptians, Greeks, and Romans had done. For other surfaces, he used cubes of glass or enamel in every shade cut in various sizes, but usually an eighth of an inch square. Precious stones were sometimes mingled with the cubes. Mosaic was often employed in making portable pictures or icons to be set up in churches or homes, or carried on travels as aids to devotion and safety. In Byzantium, every house, almost every person, carried some textile finery. Egypt led the way here with its delicate, many-colored, figured fabrics. Garments, curtains, hangings, and coverings. The Coptics were the masters in these fields. Byzantine weavers made silk brocades, embroidered, and even embroidered shrouds. Linens realistically painted with the features of the dead. In Constantinople, man was known by the garments he wore. Each class prized and defended some distinctive refinement of dress, and a Byzantine assemblage doubtless shone like a peacock's tail. Among all classes, music was popular. Music played a rising role in the liturgy of the church and helped diffuse emotion into belief. Once again, the arts are an enormously powerful way to aid the worship of God. More aspects of Catholic art after this break.
Redbox Media invites you to bless the yes. Your designated parish, school, club, or nonprofit will receive 50% of all revenue from the sponsorships. To find out more about Bless the Yes, visit BreadboxMedia.com.
This is BreadboxMedia.com.
Welcome back. Charles Coughlin here. Before the break, I presented a picture of Byzantine art, but this is a small proportion of the art of Christendom, since by far the greatest proportion of this art was done within the Catholic world. A more accurate term than Christendom in this context would be Catholicdom. I'm aware that this is a bold proposition, but it's a true one nonetheless. What was occurring in the western part of that area was phenomenal in all the areas of the arts and sciences. The quality, the content, the spiritual exaltation, and the sheer volume of what was being produced in the visual arts in Catholicdom has for almost 2,000 years towered over the accomplishments in the visual arts outside the Catholic influence. And this is not to disparage the magnificence of Oriental art, but it's just to point out that the visual arts experienced a robust and unequaled flowering within the Catholic world that simply did not occur elsewhere. One could make the point that it appears to be a byproduct of Catholic spirituality. But one might realize that it is more than a byproduct, a product. It is circular. It is a medium. It is part of a systemic process of spirituality and relationship with God, with which we evangelize. It is a medium with which we inspire. It is perhaps God speaking through us, the Holy Spirit, in inspiration, breathing into us, beauty that has been translated into human form, images of human forms, images of the natural world, an imagined image. I've been pointing out the unequal distribution of accomplishments in the arts inside of Christendom and outside of Christendom, because the visual arts that have emerged from the artists in the Catholic world represent a towering achievement, which is unmatched in the rest of the world. I'm aware that this is a bold proposition, but it is possible to find broad support for this proposition in the analyses of many aestheticians, people that study the world of the visual arts, and within cultural anthropology. Prior to 1960, when that science sadly became politicized. But it has great support. In Charles Murray's book, The Human Accomplishment, applies statistical analysis to this proposition, and it bears out very well. Now, as a warning, I want to insert that this is not the prosperity gospel. I'm not pointing out that the accomplishments of the Catholic Church in the visual arts are anything like one of the main points of Catholic spirituality. That is not the case. They are ancillary. Let's return to Charles Murray and his book, Human Accomplishment. Murray's main points are presented in a very candid fashion which he extensively backs up with empirical data, with statistics. Charles Murray is a statistician. On page 258, he presents a challenge. Charles Murray says, "My contention is that there is no significant body of ignored non-European accomplishment out there for the historical period represented by 800 BC to 1950 AD. Let me make this point in the form of a challenge that embraces the inventories for both the arts and the sciences. For the sciences, we have a specific target to shoot at, the 97% figure that defines the proportion of scientific accomplishment that I assign to Europe and North America." I want to insert in this quote from Charles Murray that I'm using the phrase Western Europe and North America as a phrase that defines an area of major Catholic influence. Let me continue my quote from Charles Murray. "The challenge is to augment the list of non-European people and events in such a way that it will meaningfully alter the 97% figure." And he goes on to show that no matter how you change the criteria, it comes out the same way. And he describes a similar imbalance of achievement in the arts. But he does point out that for the arts, we have no equivalent hard target, for the arts are more difficult to define. So Charles Murray applies the method of looking at significant figures, significant creators of the arts. And what does he discover? 74%, he says, of the significant figures in the visual arts and literature come from the West. For West, you can substitute the word Christendom, which the West used to be called. Murray further states that, "And as we already know, the methodology used to identify significant figures in the arts substantially inflates the non-Western numbers." This hour in which I've attempted to describe this complex and vast subject has almost expired, and I've only scratched the surface. In future programs, I will take specific aspects of the arts and sciences and examine them in much more detail, and cite the Catholic influence that has been powerful beyond all expectation, and to a far greater degree than is generally attributed. In the spirit of presenting vast things in miniature, I'm going to take the last minutes to just touch upon the Renaissance. The greatest outburst of innovation and sheer accomplishment in the world of art since antiquity occurred during the Renaissance in Western Europe, in Christendom, in the Catholic domain of the 15th and 16th centuries. The Renaissance is not easily pigeonholed. On the one hand, much of it appears to herald the coming of the modern world. Secularism is increasingly present, as is an increasing emphasis on worldly life. Tales of immorality are legion. Little wonder, then, that some Catholics are inclined to reject the Renaissance from root and branch. On the other hand, the Renaissance can with some justice be described as the fulfillment of the Middle Ages, rather than as a radical break from them. Medieval thinkers, like Renaissance figures, possessed a profound respect for classical antiquity, even if they did not accept the entire classical inheritance uncritically, as did some Renaissance humanists. And it is in the late Middle Ages that we find the origins of important artistic techniques that would be perfected during the Renaissance. Moreover, so many of its masterpieces depict Catholic themes, and the popes themselves served as patrons of some of the greatest masters. The truth of the matter appears to be as follows, and this is outlined by Thomas Woods, how the Catholic Church built Western civilization. 1. Important artistic innovations were already occurring prior to the time traditionally associated with the Renaissance. 2. In areas other than art, the Renaissance period was one of stagnation or even retrogression. 3. A trend toward secularism was certainly evident during the time, but 4. The vast bulk of Renaissance art was religious in nature and can be enjoyed today, thanks to the patronage of the Renaissance Pope. This is not to say that the spirit of secularism was not certainly evident during the Renaissance. Although the doctrine of original sin was rarely denied in any explicit way, a much more favorable view of human nature and its potential now became evident. With the coming of the Renaissance, we saw a celebration of the natural man. However, something else was going on that is not generally acknowledged. The vast bulk of the artistic work during the Renaissance depicts religious themes, and much of it comes from men whose art was deeply inspired by a sincere and profound religious faith. According to Kenneth Clark, author of the widely acclaimed Civilization PBS series, and I quote from him, Guercino spent much of his mornings in prayer. Bernini frequently went on retreats and practiced the spiritual exercises of St. Ignatius. These two men are major artists. Then there's Rubens. Rubens went to Mass every day, according to Clark, before beginning work. The religious practice of these men and the other Renaissance artists was based on the perfectly simple belief that the faith which had inspired the great saints of the preceding generations was something by which a man should regulate his life. The mid-16th century, the Renaissance, was a period of sanctity in the Roman Church. Such people as St. Ignatius Loyola, the visionary soldier turned psychologist, the popes, particularly such figures as Julius II and Leo X, were great patrons of many of these artists. It was during the pontificate of Pope Julius II and under his patronage that such figures as Bramante, Michelangelo, and Raphael produced some of their most memorable works of art. The Catholic Encyclopedia points to the significance of Pope Julius in contending that when the question arose as to whether the Church would absorb, reject, and condemn progress, whether or not it was associate itself with the humanistic spirit, Julius II deserves the credit for having taken sides with the Renaissance and prepared the stage for the moral triumph of the Church. The great creations of Julius II, Bramante, St. Peter's, and Raphael's Vatican, are inseparable from the great ideas of humanity and culture represented by the Catholic Church. Here, art surpasses itself, becoming the language of something higher, the symbol of one of the noblest harmonies ever realized by human nature. At the will of this extraordinary man, Rome became, at the end of the 16th century, the meeting place and center of all that was great in art and thought. We can once again profit from the judgments of the great historian Will Durant, who explained that Leo X's court was, quote, the center of the intellect and wit of Rome, the place where scholars, educators, poets, artists, and musicians were welcomed or housed, the scene of solemn ecclesiastical functions, ceremonious diplomatic receptions, costly banquets, dramatic or musical performances, poetical recitations and exhibitions of art. It was, without question, the most refined court in the world at the time. The labors of the popes from Nicholas V to Leo himself, in the improvement and adornment of the Vatican, in the assemblage of literary and artistic genius, and of the ablest ambassadors in Europe, made the court of Leo the zenith not of the art, for that had come under Julius, but of the literature and brilliance of the Renaissance. In mere quantity of culture, history had never seen its equal, not even in Periclean Athens or Augustan Rome. This has been setting the record straight.
This is breadboxmedia.com.